Mark Revisited, study number 5.
Chapter 1 of Mark, verses 29 to 34, and as a title, The Healing Miracles. Mark 1, 29. As soon as they left the synagogue, they went with James and John to the home of Simon and Andrew. Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever, and they told Jesus about her. So he went to her, took her hand, and helped her up. The fever left her, and she began to wait on them. That evening after sunset, the people brought to Jesus all the sick and demon-possessed. The whole town gathered at the door, and Jesus healed many who had various diseases. He also drove out many demons, but he would not let the demons speak, because they knew who he was. For those of you with sufficient stamina still to be with me on this fresh journey through Mark, I would say two things. First, thanks for your company. I don't want to be talking to myself. And secondly, we've got a little bit ahead of ourselves, my fault. I became overexcited in the synagogue, that usually rather dull place, so we must retrace our steps just a little. Let's rejoin the 4 newly recruited disciples as they start out on their training. Their initial experiences are truly extraordinary. In verses 21 to 34 of chapter 1, we have 2 sections of comparable proportions. At the risk of too great compression, we can summarize them like this. In the synagogue, verses 21 to 28, Jesus is victorious over the invisible world. Satan's unhindered sway is over. A grand anticipation of that day when the ancient serpent will be thrown into the lake of burning sulfur, along with the beast and the false prophet. Revelation 20:10. From now on, therefore, the devil, however loud he may roar, is subject to a sovereign lord. The next section, verses 29 to 34, to which we've now come, shows Jesus victorious over the visible world, where hitherto the reign of sickness and death have caused infinite wretchedness, pain, and grief. The relief of suffering the disciples are now witnessing at that little house of Simon and Andrew's, it's unprecedented, and it anticipates the great day when the last enemy, death, will be no more, since the old order of things has passed away. So pause for a moment and consider what our 4 men, Simon and Andrew, James and John, have actually seen. All these ancient enemies of mankind, subject to their new master, at a word of command, nothing else and nothing more. What they saw then pointed to the possibility of a transformed world, an entirely new existence for the people. It's a glorious vista, on then to fame and fortune. Nevertheless, as shortly we discover, this road to glory here and now the Lord did not take, to the bewilderment of the disciples, even to their irritation. How much as yet they understood, we can only guess, but we today can appreciate very well why Jesus refused that popular way. A restored creation, a new Eden, is not a suitable home to live in for unrepentant and rebel sinners. One day when there is a restored world, a true paradise, a new heaven and a new earth, it will properly be the home of a redeemed and ransomed people. For it was to prepare just such a people from all nations that Jesus came. Meanwhile, it can't escape our notice that this gospel purpose for the Son of God opens the door for the commonest of all grounds for unbelief. How often we hear that the presence of suffering in our world prevents faith in a God of love. It goes somewhat like this. Either God cares, but lacks the power to intervene, or he has that power, but doesn't sufficiently care. This, in its various forms, is the complaint. And from this dilemma, I recall a man of high intelligence saying to me personally, "There is no escape." And yet, as we now begin to witness the awesome power of Jesus in Mark's story, and the wondrous compassion of Jesus to the helpless, the leper, the paralytic, the dying, We also witness the implacable hostility of the nation's leaders toward him. The terrible truth of the human predicament really is inescapable. We live in a world that crucified the Christ of power and love, and will crucify him still. Such a world must always lie under the just judgment of God, as vividly described in Mark chapter 13. Did Mark plan to establish the brutal fact of man's wickedness and senseless antagonism toward the Son of God early in his record? It might explain his choice of another synagogue visit early in Christ's ministry, even before the full 12 were appointed, a visit that ended with an agreed plot to kill him, 3:1-6. For us, it is only in the context of the world's desire to rid itself of the King of Glory that we can sensibly discuss the state of the world as described by the Lord in Mark 13, a world of war, famine, suffering, and unbelief. But it's high time we joined the company at Simon's house for Sabbath lunch. It's a happy occasion. A few minutes earlier, the hostess has been instantly cured of a troublesome and enervating fever by the chief guest. Apparently, she'd needed no time at all to recuperate or recover her normal energy, for she immediately returned to her usual hospitable ways and served the company a characteristic mark and touch. Well might a modern guest have said, "It's really miraculous how she did it." And that, of course, was the literal truth. So here we, the readers, are introduced to the healing miracles of Christ, creative, instantaneous, and permanent in their results. There will be time later on, as we study these mighty works, to seek out their meaning both for then and for now. Sufficient at present to note one thing only: the sensational effect of this quiet healing in a private house, witnessed by only a handful of people. I take it that Mark intends us to see that the race to Simon's front door immediately Sabbath was over. Of all who could come, with every sick and tormented friend and neighbour they could bring, was a direct result of the news getting out, as such news always will, that a real, authentic miracle had taken place in that home. It's time to get real. The gospel miracles we are going to read about are of this kind. A quadriplegic leaps up from his mat on the floor to walk away in confidence, strength, and joy. No visit is necessary to Stoke Mandeville to learn through weary months to use again wasted muscles and disabled limbs. Yet recently I read from a distinguished scholar of a previous generation the following, quote, "Miracles were everyday events in an age which knew nothing about the fixity of natural laws, and every village had its wonder worker. To cast out a demon or work some other kind of miracle was no proof of divinity. One might be in league with Beelzebub or some other spirit. A good man, particularly a teacher of the law, could reasonably be expected to have the power to heal and to cast out evil spirits." Unquote. I hasten to say that this writer was capable of better things than that, but for silliness and for sheer absurdity it is really hard to beat. Did he honestly think that the magicians of Jesus' day could do mighty works comparable to the Lord's? Or that the villagers of that day could not see the difference between local marvels, such as there were, and what Jesus was doing among them? Or that Mark was unable to distinguish between chalk and cheese? There is a blindness in that kind of theological literature. Perhaps a hangover from earlier days when it was customary to rationalize away the gospel miracles altogether. The plain testimony of Mark, a Christian pledged to truthful speech, is that the common people of the new day knew perfectly well that they'd never seen anything like what Jesus was doing among them. The matchless nature of these supernatural healings testified to the matchless nature of the one who did them. The question of being asked everywhere, by everybody, was, who then is this? Let's imagine a modern analogy. We are in the children's leukemia ward of a London hospital. The ward sister had in fact told me of this situation. A lad has come in who was expected to captain a junior national football team. Now he too is very ill, with a poor prognosis. However, a remarkable visitor passes by, staying only a short while, and with just a word from him, all are instantly made well. In a trice, they're all up, dressed, and ready to be fetched by their rejoicing parents. But how very difficult, if not impossible, to reach the hospital. The news is out, and therefore the roads are gridlocked, with cars full of sick and dying, desperate to reach this man. The airports announce crowded extra planes planning to arrive in the next few days. The newspaper headlines have only one story to tell. Now, making adjustments for modern conditions, read Mark 3:7-12. It's the same story. Nothing will stop the crowds wanting to touch the Lord Jesus. It's a leading Markan theme. Even to the point of danger, Jesus must be taken offshore to avoid being crushed by an importunate people. That is the reality in this story. This, then, is not the stuff of healing crusades, leave alone faith healing, however sincere. This is unique, unprecedented, unparalleled. And is what Mark sets out to tell us? Well, is there any good reason not to take him at his word? A postscript. The 20th century saw very different reactions to the gospel miracles. In the first quarter of the century, it seemed to many people all but impossible to go against the prevailing tides of doubt and disbelief. The hangover from this is still with us today, as in the quotation I read. By contrast, as the century came to an end, numerous churches were to be found seriously committed to teaching that given sufficient faith, we were to expect to experience healing miracles similar to those described in the Gospels. Similar confusions to these are still with us and likely to continue. Most preachers will have to find their own way through such fogs, fanaticisms, and fashions in order to reach their own secure position. I want to make one suggestion, that we target those capable of teaching others with the bigger reference books, those that last a lifetime. In the 1950s, I had the privilege of accompanying Dick Rees, an evangelist of some renown, on a visit to Ontario in Canada. Three of us covered 9 churches in the 3 weeks' stay. It began at the cathedral, where, to my astonishment, Mr. Rees had ordered huge crates of Christian books to be sent out for distribution, and solid volumes at that, like, for example, the New Bible Commentary just published by IVP. Dick Rees was a shameless, brilliant, charming, successful salesman. These books in the hundreds and thousands must still be scattered over the largest areas of Ontario, a kind of major Christian literature, unknown, I would guess, before. I have this morning checked the New Bible Dictionary, 3rd edition, for an article on the miracles of Christ. It covers so much valuable ground. Why should not the larger churches order 50-plus copies and get these into the hands of families and individuals who are able to value their help for years to come? Or better, 100 copies. Even now, church plants ought to be able to dispose of a dozen if skillfully presented with a decent discount. In this way, may sound learning prevail amongst us.